I said, okay, well, I'm sorry I didn't make an appointment, but I just got cut by the Celtics this morning. I was hoping I wouldn't be here. And she said, what? She said, hold on a minute. I'll never forget it. And 2 minutes later, the guy comes out with her and he said, you're a salesman.
Welcome to Learning Life.
And the thing that I've realized, from the CEO to the NFL football player to the janitor, we're our toughest critics and we're hardest on ourselves.
But you have to be willing to say and point out the things that need to be said.
The only way to grab somebody's attention is with a story.
Welcome to Learning Life with John Toda and another episode in the Vermont Local Series. My guest today is Rich Tarrant, and I'm excited to have such an accomplished Vermont entrepreneur with me on the show. Rich's career is an amazing journey, and he did it here long before it was popular to build a tech business in the Green Mountains. Rich is a pioneer in the healthcare industry, co-founding Burlington Data Processing back in 1969. That company became IDX Systems Corporation and was later acquired by GE Healthcare. Rich then went on to invest in and create new businesses in Vermont, including his latest company, Marathon Health, based in Winooski. And along the way, he made a foray into politics as a Republican nominee for U.S. Senator from Vermont in the 2006 election against Bernie Sanders. Rich and his wife Deb are also active philanthropists in Vermont through their Richard E. and Deborah L. Tarrant Foundation, where they've been recognized for their contributions to Vermont education. And it all started with Rich taking the St. Michael's Purple Knights to a Final Four in 1965, and later getting drafted to the NBA by the Boston Celtics, which somehow led him to his first sales job with IBM. There's a ton to learn from Rich, so let's get into it. Rich, welcome to Learning Life.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
So, you know, I always like to find out how everyone came to Vermont, and I know you're originally from New Jersey, but that's kind of the genesis of all of it, was your basketball career. Tell us a little bit about how you got to St. Michael's and how that kind of turned you on to Vermont.
Okay. Well, in high school, I was on the basketball team, but I never started, and most of the time I was on the bench. And I decided after my senior year, I was really going to work on basketball. I was growing, and I thought that was going to be my sport. So I did, and I went to St. Bonaventure as a walk-on. They were a powerhouse, and I played pretty well there, but they wouldn't give me a scholarship. So long story short, I wrote some letters to other schools, one of which was St. Mike's, and they responded, and I decided to go at St. Mike's on a scholarship.
And so you obviously had a lot of success in your basketball career at St. Mike's, and I know your 22 jersey is retired in the rafters there. And so you guys went to the Final Four. What was that like for you?
Well, it was interesting because people think it was the Final Four of Division II, but back then, so long ago, they didn't have Division I, II, and III. What they had is University Division and College Division, and then they had what they called NAIA. But those are equivalent to I, II, and III, except we weren't in the Final Four of the College Division. And the difference between that and the University Division was just whatever you wanted to be, and you could choose your division, basically. So it was interesting that the Final Four back then was us in Southern Illinois with Walt Frazier, big Division I now, Jerry Sloan in Evansville, big Division I guy now, and who else was there? Oh, Phil Jackson in North Dakota. It was more than what's now called Division II. There was a lot of what D1 teams or D1 now. So, you know, going, it was in Indiana, in Evansville, Indiana, and it was, you know, it was exciting. There were a lot of pro scouts there and so on and so forth. And we did well and came back, and I got a call from Tony Adams. When was it? Right, probably April of 65. He was the local sports writer. You may know him, sportscaster, and told me I was drafted by the Celtics. Well, I had some inquiries from different pro teams, but I had gone to Red Auerbach camp the year before, and I pretty much thought they might be interested in me, and sure enough, they drafted me.
Oh, man, that is so cool. So, yeah, you are definitely one of the more notable Vermont basketball players, and I know you're in the Vermont Hall of Fame for sports, too, right?
Yeah,
that's awesome. That's so cool. And you played against so many icons in basketball. So that's awesome for any basketball fan like me. And then after your time with the Boston Celtics, I know you started working for IBM, and that's what kind of got you into the technology space at that time, right?
Right. And what happened there was, I knew IBM was a great company back then, and still is, of course, but being an IBM sales rep was kind of an in place to be in those days. And so we were staying at the hotel, Lenox Hotel in Boston. And of course, I'll never forget the morning when Red Orbeck told me I could make a living somewhere else a lot better. And so I got back to the hotel. Ironically, the hotel was right near the IBM New England office, which all of New England, and the regional manager was there. And I just put my suit on and went down, knocked on the door, and said I'd like to meet with so-and-so, the regional manager. And the lady said, "Do you have an appointment?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, yeah, you have to call, make an appointment, and he's really busy." I said, "Okay, well, I'm sorry I didn't make an appointment, but I just got cut by the Celtics this morning. I was hoping I wouldn't be here." And she said, "What?" And I repeated it. And she said, "Hold on a minute. I'll never forget it. Hold on a minute." And I wasn't doing this for any reason other than I just happened to tell her why I didn't make an appointment. So, and 2 minutes later, the guy comes out with her. And he said to me, he said, "You're a salesman." I said, "Huh?" So he, of course, I went in and had the interview. And basically, when I walked out, I had a job pretty much. As a salesman in Vermont, but he thought I had designed that whole thing to say that to get in the door, which is a good sales pitch, I guess. Yeah. Anyway, so he said, "Well, we have a spot open in Vermont, actually a sales spot. You want to go back there?" And I said, "Sure." And it was interesting because I never had a business course. I still haven't. I've never had a business course, accounting, economics, nothing, never. So when I went back to Vermont, they said, you know, I'd be at sales school and app school, and other things. And that's how I learned I went to my first IBM school. And I literally did not know that an invoice was a bill. And that was really embarrassing. So anyway, my partner and I, Bob Hale, had been there. He played basketball with me at St. Mike's, and he had been at IBM in Vermont. And we worked there for about 3 years and then left to start what was then Burlington Data Processing.
Yeah. And so now when you made that decision to leave IBM, which, like you said, at the time, everybody knows IBM, a job at IBM, particularly in sales, no one would ever want to leave and take this chance on starting something new. But you guys did, and you decided, and obviously the original name was Burlington Data Processing. So you decided to open it here in Burlington and get into healthcare. What was the reasoning behind that? Did you have a background in healthcare? Did you guys just see some real fit and need in the market at that time?
Well, back then, the real value add that you were selling is the hardware, computer hardware servers, as we call them today, because they were so expensive that you could make money by sharing. And at the end of the day, when you've used 100% of the computer sharing with others, you had a profit left. So what happened was we got an IBM computer. Actually, we started a second shift at Hebig Super Temp, buying computer time for $10 an hour because I knew them pretty well and they were my customer at IBM. But what the business was is Bob Hale would write a program. We didn't care. He'd write any program, manufacturing, distribution, shoe stores, oil, anything, because we just wanted to use that hardware and sell the hardware. So he'd write every program he'd ever want. He was great at it. And one day we were at a seminar and we learned about this one company that was specializing in payroll. And they were talking about how great it was to specialize because you didn't have to write a program for every customer. So they really got good at payroll. And they were a Chicago company, I think. And decided to specialize in it. So Bob and I said, you know, that makes sense. What are we going to specialize? Well, at IBM, I was a manufacturing and distribution sales rep. And Bob was government and education, rather. And so, of course, we decided on healthcare. But the reason we did is we looked around Vermont. We said, okay, what's the big business here? What's the industry? And, of course, with the University of Vermont College of Medicine, for the size of our town, we were big in healthcare. And so we decided to learn healthcare and just started writing programs and selling.
That's amazing. And so I'm interviewing all these entrepreneurs who are operating and trying to scale their business here in Vermont today. But you guys were doing this back in the 70s. What was the entrepreneurial community like here? How much more challenging was it back then to do what people are trying to do now?
Well, first of all, that was not a digital era. Yeah, we were doing digital stuff because it was, quote, computers. So it's so different then. I think then it probably was harder to expand and scale, but also in some ways it was easier because once you got a niche, you didn't have to worry about somebody writing an app in their basement and being able to go on the internet and compete with you all over the country. No internet. We were really not a digital company because there was no digital industry. We were computers and software. And that's a big difference in terms of what kind of business you're talking about.
Yeah. And I can imagine you were the one heading up sales right from the beginning. Selling today is like, you know, not a challenge at all. You know, you could sell anywhere virtually, but you must have been traveling all over the place to try and expand and get into different markets, you know, because you couldn't do it all just from this one corner of the country.
No, right. And it took a while before we got to the technology. Back then we called it online real time, which is what everything is today. But there was no internet as such. So our next step was to use what was known as leased lines. So we would start leasing lines and getting online. We used Digital Equipment Corp hardware back then and got an online real time offering out there. And that was really cutting edge back then, and it made it easier to expand, except it was so expensive to lease telephone lines all over the country. So as part of that, then we started actually selling the servers, or computers we called them then, but selling the computers along with the software to customers. And since we were getting into bigger and bigger customers, especially academic medical centers, the computers that they needed were pretty good size. And so the dollars were very big. And, you know, one thing led to another. And basically, we got really going in healthcare because of the University College of Medicine and hospital and so forth around here. But we are an academic medical center here in Burlington. So we really got some specialties going in that area. And we started focusing on academic medical centers around the country because they know everybody. They have the conferences. And by the time we were done, we probably had at least 85% of all academic medical centers in the country and a couple in Europe. So we really specialized within healthcare on academic medical centers. And again, they were bigger. They needed bigger computers, more hardware, more software. So it became almost a software company. More than hardware, definitely more software, more than hardware. So we were kind of morphing into software and recognizing that hardware was just a commodity.
Yeah. And it must be fascinating for you to see the way the technology has evolved to where it is today, because what you guys were doing was almost a very early form of software as a service, running it through leased lines and client server environments. And today now everyone talks about cloud computing and everything, but you guys were convincing healthcare providers, a difficult industry to make change in, to digitize and communicate electronically with doctor's offices back in the 70s. I mean, how challenging was it to be a pioneer on the leading edge like that to try and get big organizations to make a change?
Well, yeah, it was a tough sell. But interesting, John, once you got one or two, and especially the University of Vermont, to this day, I thank them because they took the big chance. They went out to bid, and we were the local company, really new in the academic world. And they went out to bid in nationwide companies. And we just thought if we could just get this one. And sure enough, I'll never forget the day that I got a call from Jim Rochelle, who's since passed, and he ran the medical, the academic practice plan here. And he said, you got it. Let's start talking contract. And that was a huge day. I mean, you know, just because they're so recognized in a different industry, if you got a big customer here, that'd be great, but probably not as close an industry as defined an industry as academic medicine was.
Yeah.
I mean, once we could say we had one, and then we go from there to Nebraska, to UCLA, to Duke and Hopkins and all the big ones. We had them all the big ones.
Yeah.
And as you became the specialist, then you went to the conventions that were academic medical center conventions, and we had the biggest booth and the biggest, we were the guy in healthcare IT.
Yeah, I think it's such a good lesson for any entrepreneur to learn is this value of being that specialized, to really focus on your vertical market, be the very best in whatever industry you can cater to and really, really be the best at. And it really worked for you guys. And I think it's such a great success story, obviously acquired by GE Healthcare. And then you went on and started, you know, obviously I got connected with you through our mutual contact, John Blaze, who's over at Marathon Health. And I started doing research, and obviously he's told me all about the story of Marathon. But you and I were talking about it a little bit before, and it's almost as revolutionary and innovative in this side of the healthcare industry as what you did with the technology back with IDX. Tell us a little bit about what the genesis was of Marathon Health and why it's so important.
Sure. Well, we sold IDX in 2005 to GE, and I jumped into politics and I ran for U.S. Senate. And my interest was healthcare because, you know, not only IDX, but sitting on the boards of local hospitals and so forth. I thought I had a pretty good background, 35 years of healthcare. So some of my closest advisors and friends at IDX and elsewhere got together and said, okay, this is that. Here's healthcare we're going to use, and that's where we're going to run. If we can get this system in the United States, will really impact the cost of care and the quality. So we started by looking at where's the real expense. And the real expense, when we looked at it, was in an area that about 70% of the cost was in 12 to 15% of the patients. 70% in 12%. So you don't have to be brilliant to say, let's focus on the 12%. And we dug a little deeper to find, okay, why is this, what is this 12 to 15%? Why are they different? Why do they cost so much? Well, as it turned out, they were patients with multiple chronic diseases and sicknesses, and they were visiting multiple specialist doctors, having multiple lab tests, multiple imaging x-rays, multiple admissions to the hospital, and very confusing in terms of data. And we knew that pretty well because we were part of a group at IDX that were trying to, we had different initiatives around the country to build this magic database. And as it turns out, even today, that as good as the technology is, it's very hard to get a database that you can really count on when you're seeing a patient the physician can count on. And as I mentioned, these patients are seeing multiple specialists, all with their own database, and hard to keep it all intact or it's consistent, because you may not know that another doctor already ordered this lab test, and on and on and on. So bottom line is, we said, okay, how do we specialize? And we specialized by managing that 12%. What we had to do is find that 12% first. So when we go into a customer, we had some pretty big customers, and we would have different ways of identifying the 12%. We could look into the insurance records, unidentified, and see what kind of diseases they had and so on and forth. So we identify them by name, but only for us. We didn't even let the executives of the companies who are our customers know who they were. And then we worked on getting them in to see us. And I use the term making them love us, but it was a little more sophisticated than that. We'd go out and find them in the companies they worked in the cafeteria, or they might show up because they have a cold. And we say, hey, John, you know, we'd like to talk to you about this, that. And after a while, the patients just got to love our nurses and specialists, physician assistants and so forth. And then they would come and they would listen. They would let us help them manage this monstrosity that they were trying to manage. And then we started really showing some results that we've reduced the cost of healthcare for our patients, probably over a little over $1 billion the last time we looked. And that's a monstrous amount of savings for 12% of this population that we were dealing with. And the quality was off the scales. It was fabulous. And it's running today, and it's doing great. It worked.
Yeah. It's such an interesting pivot to your story, because I think the first part of your career, you really were known for digitizing the healthcare industry. And then in the second evolution, it's kind of personalizing it so much where, like, I love how you say it's changing the relationship between the patient and the healthcare provider, making them trust more and really kind of hitting that same problem from the other side. And again, you mentioned it too about specializing. So you kind of had that same strategy of saying, okay, let's hyper-focus on just that 12 to 15%, but you're kind of trying to solve the same problem from different sides, I guess, at this point in your career, right?
Exactly. But John, I want to be clear that I didn't want to suggest that they didn't trust their doctors then. It was more of it was complicated to manage because it wasn't organized as well as it should be. But the doctors were certainly very trustworthy. And in fact, they were critical. We used all the doctors in the communities. We didn't hire all specialists. We just knew how to manage the referrals and where they move in the community and that type of thing, really organizing stuff.
Yeah. And because I see it all the time with family members of my own where they've got, six or seven different doctors all prescribing different things and there's not always coordination between them. And so it just kind of became, I guess, that you probably saw this happening because you've been so rooted in the healthcare industry that as it grew, there was never one doctor that could handle everything for a patient. So if in the absence of that consolidation, it was, you always had, as you get older and you have more problems, you just got so many doctors and different advice. And there's the coordination is probably the biggest challenge, right?
Absolutely. You hit it on the head.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I think it's just so interesting to see how you've stayed in this industry and solved it from so many different perspectives. And I know you referenced about your campaign in 2006 and how that was just a passion for you, healthcare, and it kind of came out of that. How do you see this going? Because obviously you've been tied to politics in one form or another for a while now. So how do you see Vermont doing with that? How's Governor Scott doing with Vermont in the areas of education and healthcare?
Good question. I don't think we've made great advancement over the years on this because it's so complicated. And without getting too far into the weeds, John, think about how, and you hit on how complicated the human body is. It's so complicated that we have specialists for just the hand. Look at your hand. Look at the skin. Think about the nerves. Think about the bones in it. Think about the fingernails, the wrist. Holy mackerel.
Yeah.
One person, that's why we have hand specialists. So how many other pieces of that complex body are specialized? They had to be specialized because it's too much to learn. So what's happened is by necessity, we've grown a healthcare system in this country that's based on specialty. And what we've got is an episodic care system. So if you have a bad hand, you go to the hand doctor. If you have this or that. But if you have something that covers, as I said, multiple diseases, multiple chronic illnesses, we're forced with dealing with the system that's evolved because of this need for specialists. So it's a catch-22. We have episodic system or episodic actions. So you got you broke your leg, you go to an orthopod. You got a headache, you go to a neurologist. And then you're trying to put it all together when somebody has diabetes. How many different specialists do you need? Even though it'd be ideal if there were fewer specialists and more generalists that knew these different things, but it's impossible. It's too much to learn. This body is such a, it is so impossible. Think about it. Think about what we're trying to do. And we want to live forever. We never say it, but Americans want immortality and they want someone else to pay for it. And then they call it a right. It's too hard to do that. It's just too darn hard, but we have to live with it. That's for obvious reasons. I stated it's a complex industry and it's a complex business and it's complex healing. And we're stuck with an episodic system because it's so complex.
Do you think that states should be handling that? Do you think that's a national situation that should be managed through national healthcare? Or what do you see as a solution? Is it something that businesses have to tackle?
What I think the solution is first of all, to recognize what the issues are. And you have to get control of that database. So no matter where that patient is, the provider that's seeing him or her then has everything possible. There's nothing, no other doctor that ordered something that they don't know about. And here's the catch-22. There's only one piece of the healthcare industry that can do that. Only one. And guess what that one is? Everybody hates this answer. That one is the insurance company. They've got all the data. Nobody else has all the data. And of course, insurance companies are bad, right? I mean, of course, and pharmaceuticals are bad. But the insurance company has got the data. It needs a little more to make it a full patient record, but it also follows the patient around. Because I can go to Montana tomorrow and say, I got Blue Cross Blue Shield, and fine. And if they had the record, a doctor could go online in Montana and say, here is everything that's happened to Rich Tarrant, everything. But, and that's what, in politics, I try to get that across. But, you know, when you're trying in politics, right, to make the insurance company the key, it's pretty hard to sell. There is nobody else that can coordinate it. Nobody.
Yeah, it's really kind of an interesting problem because we all know that, and there isn't any one place or, you know, one organization at the government level that has that same level of data. And like you said, it's just not a popular stance to say that it's got to come through the insurance companies. So now, for you, how do you see healthcare has been such an important piece of your entire career? You've been solving problems in this area and from all these different angles. For you now, where does that passion go? Are you feeling you can continue to make the most change working in the corporate side of the world? Do you consider another foray into politics, another run for an office? How do you think you can really further what you've been doing on the healthcare front?
Well, John, I'm not interested in getting back into politics at all. But I'm still chairman of Marathon Health, and I like how it's growing and what it's doing. But I'm not aiming to get into healthcare again with anything else. And you know, I have some other businesses, but you know, I'm 79 years old, so I can only do so many things. And my loved ones are trying to convince me that I should retire. And that's not happening.
Yeah, I think you seem to have a lot of energy to keep making things happen. And I think also just to recognize all the great things that you've been doing through your foundation. And what are you most proud about with what you've been able to do with the foundation and where you've been able to kind of really impact and make change? I know you've done some stuff with the public school system. I think it was in Milton and some other things for education. Where's your passion go in that area?
Well, that you're referring to the Tarrant Institute at the University of Vermont. And yeah, Milton was the first middle school. We now have about 80 middle schools throughout the state. And it's just going fabulously well. It is so successful. We just absolutely love it.
Yeah, it's just awesome to see all the great things you've done for Vermont and just to be an inspiration to entrepreneurs everywhere that are trying to scale their businesses and change their industry. It's just an amazing story, all that you've accomplished in your career here. So thank you for taking the time and sharing your story with our audience.
You're welcome, John. My pleasure.
And to all of our listeners, thank you for being here each week. As you know, we have a new episode that comes out every Tuesday. So wherever you're listening, be sure to subscribe and leave us comments. We'd love to hear from you guys. And until our next episode, happy learning. Hey everyone, John Tota here. I want to thank you for tuning into the show each week. We love our Learning Life community and are so grateful for your support. We'd appreciate it if you would take a minute to rate us and write a review for Learning Life wherever you're listening right now. Your ratings and comments help new people find the show so we can keep growing our community and bringing great interviews on the topics you care most about.